Hey YouTube, this is City Prepping. I'm actually driving around out here in the mountains in an area nearby where I live, looking at some land right now. Definitely looking for some bug out property here in the next 6 months, and thought I'd pull over real quick and do a quick video talking about a subject matter that's been on my mind for a little while. It's in relation to the conversations that typically come up in the prepper community about Civil War, Great Reset, these different kind of concepts of, hey, let's burn it down and start all over again because, you know, we want things to be different. We want to start over. We want to start fresh. A lot of people are frustrated with the current system and they feel like it's left them behind or does it work? And what I want to do in this video is just share some points that I learned while living in Afghanistan. I've shared a few times on the channel that I went to Afghanistan in 2003. I was there for 3 months. I did NGO work. I worked with a team of missionaries, physicians. We provided medical relief and humanitarian aid in the city of Kabul. And I went, at that time I was an occupational minister, and I went to help serve the community. Having said that, I observed the impact of Civil War firsthand. And I know a lot of times people are kind of cavalier in the discussion and their attitude of, hey, you know, let's just start all over again. It would be better that we do it that way. Again, I think a lot of that's, out of frustration. And all I can say is firsthand, after seeing and living in a nation that had gone through Civil War, the time when I got there, they'd gone through having the Russians come in during the late 70s and 80s, and then the early 90s when they had their own collapse with the power vacuums, with different warlords fighting for territory. They, in a sense, had their own Civil War. And, you know, one of the first things that really struck me living there is if you live in a country where there's either been Civil War or it's just occurred, things are going to be extremely, extremely difficult. You know, there's this notion and thinking that, hey, again, let's just burn it down, start all over. But when you live in a country where everything has been destroyed, the thing that impressed me, I remember when we flew into Kabul airport, we had to fly and come in, and the first thing you saw is along the landing strip, everything was destroyed. There's planes that were blown up. You get into the airport, it was destroyed. Anything that was vertical, any kind of structure, a building, a telephone pole, you name it, is full of RPG holes or bullet holes. Telephone poles were riddled. Buildings were destroyed. And the people, they unfortunately took the brunt of it. They lived in some of the harshest conditions. I saw buildings, everything was toppled over. There was no sense of any type of security. And I'll talk about that more in a second. But this notion of, hey, this almost glamorization of, any type of a civil war, I don't think people have any context or any idea what that looks like living in a country like that. That's the first thing that really impressed me, was just how difficult it was. People that had any talents or any ability, they got the heck out of there. They either went to Germany or other countries where they could start their life and they got their family out, or those that were fortunate enough to get out before things started, but the ones that were left behind, were desperately trying to get out. And when I was there, people were always begging, hey, is there any opportunity, any scholarship to get out of here, go to Germany, go to America? If you burn everything down, there's not going to be much left. And that was the thing that really struck me, the first thing that really impacted me. The second thing that really impacted me is a lack of having a control over your own life, your own body, your own family, your own, you name it. There was no real sense of autonomy. There was, these people lived in, such desperate areas, and it was very primal in a sense, at least when I was there. I don't know how much it's really changed. But you had these different warlords that were over different areas that had kind of taken control. And the thing that you and I love as Americans is our own sense of freedom, again, autonomy. We can do what we want, go where we want. There's no, major restrictions or impedance. But living in a country like that, where, again, it's just day-to-day survival, you just don't have that luxury. And I remember, just even venturing outside of town, you had to be really careful where you pulled over to, because there was always areas that had not been demined. The Russians, when I was there, for every one person in Afghanistan, there was two landmines that were unmapped. And you always saw in the city where I was at, there was always all these warnings, for children not to touch what looked like toys. When the Russians left, they left all these mines behind, all these traps more or less to kill kids or maim them or damage them. It was just a real common part of what those people had, gotten used to. But there was no sense of, freedom, autonomy, living your own life. And if you're in a Civil War situation, I know one of the shows that's often, mentioned in the prepping community is The Walking Dead, and characters like Negan or the governor, pop up as, whenever there's a vacuum, these leaders kind of rose to the occasion and took control over areas. And it wasn't too different than what I saw there. Every area had its own, you know, unique kind of, you know, control and authority. And your ability to be this autonomous, you know, freedom loving individual, that wasn't really that much of an option. Here we enjoy that freedom. Again, I know some people are frustrated by restrictions, but there was really no concept of freedom. The third thing that really struck me was a lack of security. We lived in an area, part of Kabul called Kartese, which means third district, if I remember my diary correctly. And all of the houses in our neighborhood had these huge, massive walls. And you had what was called a chokidor. It was somebody that would work inside your house or inside your little kind of compound to keep watch over, you know, during the day and at night. And, you know, having any kind of security was, there wasn't really anybody, any police that you could pick up and call. I mean, there was kind of some loose concepts of police there, but a lot of these guys are ex-military kind of roaming around and, you know, trying to provide help and protection. But there really wasn't a concept of security. You're kind of on your own. Now, again, some may look at that and say, yeah, you know, I've got guns or I've got this and that. But when you're living in an environment, always having to look over your shoulder, always, you know, more or less stressed out, never knowing, you know, what's going to be next, that was really tough. And, you know, if you look at the studies that show the impact of stress, what it does to a person and shortens their lifespan, a lot of these people that we dealt with and, you know, had to deal with on a daily basis, we had a medical clinic at Kabul University. We were, you know, trying to help. Some of the guys on our team, you know, were different types of, you know, different type of therapists, and they saw firsthand the impact of what stress did to these people. And that kind of leads me into the next point, the fourth point, which is a shorter lifespan. When you live with a constant state of stress, you're at a basic molecular deterioration level, or rather you experience that at a molecular level where stress really accelerates that process, where your life is now going to be shorter. I mean, you can study enough, and there's tons of evidence the impact that stress has on people's lives. And when you're living in a constant state of survival every day, you're barely making it. I mean, when I was there, the average professor would make about $75 USD a month if they were lucky, if they got paid. And, you know, seeing that firsthand was, it really struck me. I remember when one time we got in a taxi cab, and there's this gentleman that was driving us. And at that time, I was, I think, about 27, 28. And I remember talking to him, and at the time, my diary was pretty limited. I could have basic conversations, usually around the concept of numbers or, you know, costs, you know. But my friend that I was with, he had a much better grasp of diary than I did. And we were talking to this gentleman and asking him his age. And I just assumed, looking at him, had to be a good, you know, 55, pushing 60 plus. And when he explained to us, he was about 38. I remember just like, geez, looking at this guy, he looked well beyond his years. And that's what stress does to you. When you're constantly living in that environment, when things are tough, you just don't have to, you know, you don't really get to experience the fullness of life. The concept of health and these different things that we enjoy here are pretty much gone. And when I was there, the average life expectancy in 2003, according to the UN, of a, you know, typical Afghan civilian, I think was around 57. I have to go back and look at those numbers, but it was, you know, significantly low. In America, it's 77, 78. But there it was much lower. They had the highest infant mortality rate. All the different things that you and I take for granted, having a healthcare system, modern healthcare system, are gone just like that. One of the things that I noticed is you didn't see people with different health issues like Down syndrome. The reality is they just couldn't make it. There was no healthcare, there was no medical attention, and they were often abandoned if they were seen as a burden. You don't have the resources. If that comes, you know, if you have a child with different you know, health deficiencies, the reality is they're just not going to be able to make it. There is no support for them. So the thing that we enjoy so much here, the freedoms, the health, all those things, again, are gone. You just don't get to have that. The fifth thing that struck me was a lack of education. When I was there, again, this is 03, when we had helped the Northern Alliance kick out the Taliban out of Kabul. When the Taliban was in power, they had gone through and pretty much wiped out the schools. Girls weren't allowed to get an education. You know, they had to wear the burqa. They were kept in a, you know, basically at a lower level. And I remember I was trying to help these professors in the college there teach science courses, and I explained my background in microbiology. And they showed me their library. I mean, it had been completely demolished by the Taliban. And, you know, these guys didn't have any kind of resources or tools or education, any type of material. It had all been, you know, eradicated. And when you live in a post-war or live in a civil war environment or whatever you want to call it, great collapse, all these different things, great reset, education has to unfortunately go to the side of the road. I mean, it's no longer a priority when you're trying to live day-to-day surviving. And again, we live in a country where we have these freedoms. We have the ability to put our children in school. We have a future. There's things that we can do. And I love the fact that our scientific community is, you know, it's so advanced that we have these different assets in our country that make us really great and special. And these things are not, you just don't have these options when you're living in this type of day-to-day existence where, you know, again, you're just trying to survive. And one of the last points that I want to make, and this is something I alluded to a second ago, where, you know, women were put in pretty much a second-class position. When I taught in the university, in Kabul University, the women that came in and wanted to learn, that was new for them. They never really had that opportunity during the war at that level. Again, when the Taliban were in power, women just didn't have that luxury, or they weren't really allowed to be. They really weren't allowed to have an education. Again, they were treated as second-rate citizens. And, you know, the things, the advances that women have made in our culture, in our society, over the last 100 years and over the last 30 years, a lot of those things would be gone. The advancements, you know, I have a young daughter. She's 3 years old, and I'm excited for the potential for her future, the different possibilities, the things that she can do. And I, you know, so encouraged and excited for her future because, again, we live in a nation that has those opportunities. Whereas when I lived in a country like, you know, Afghanistan in particular, those options just weren't on the table. And so I bring that up because a lot of the things that I've observed, you know, I hit different points, but the things that we enjoy, the freedoms that we have here, the education, the health, you know, the quality, all these things, those are things that I think a lot of times we take for granted. And those things would be gone in an instant if we went into a, whatever you want to call it, a great reset, civil war, go into a major conflict. While I don't really foresee us going into major conflict in this country anytime soon at a entire level as far as across the entire country, I can imagine we'll probably see potentially skirmishes, probably like Ireland did during the 80s and 90s. I can't imagine we're going to be able to avoid that if we continue on this path that we're on right now. But I bring all these points up because I just want my audience, I want people that watch this to remember and to think about these different things that we have, the luxuries that we have. I know we're living in a bit of a challenging time this year with the pandemic and the lockdown, and people, you know, feel restricted. And for sure, I mean, there's a lot of things that I would love to do and just haven't been able to do so. But nothing compares to what I saw firsthand when you're living in a country that's in a constant war or just coming out of a war. Everything is demolished. I had to hear so many stories of people watching family members murdered in front of them, being shot, killed, different, you know, I saw the men all the time. A good chunk of the men that I saw walking down the street had one leg. They were on crutches because they had stepped on a landmine. And these are the things that, again, we take for granted, the freedoms that we enjoy, the goodness that we experience in this country. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, any feedback, any questions. If you want to post those in the comments section below, I always enjoy hearing back from the community. But I just want to throw my two cents into the ring on this. I mean, again, I was out here driving around, and this has been something that's been on my mind, and love to hear your thoughts. As always, stay safe out there. In 2020, we have seen riots and looting in the streets. We have seen armed forces moving through city streets and suburbs. We have even seen the quietest of gated communities filled with mobs of people. Violence in city streets can quickly escalate and be pushed out or boil over into residential or even suburban areas. I think it's safe to say that your homeowners association probably doesn't have a plan for this possibility, but you and your neighborhood should. So how do you keep your neighborhood safe from riots when they are nearing you or heading your way? In this video, we'll examine different ways to keep your neighborhood and your home safe when civil unrest is at your doorstep. Please consider subscribing to our newsletter to give you updates and member-specific content. Visit www.cityprepping.com/newsletter or click on the link in the description and comment section below to subscribe today. Enjoy the video. Blocking the entrance to your neighborhood. The best scenario you can expect is that rioters will not enter into your neighborhood. We'll discuss in more detail later in this video the tactics you can use should rioters spill in. Or preparing a defensive measure in advance to ensure they will not enter will be the first and most important step. If you know your neighbors well enough, discuss in advance any plans to block entrances to your neighborhood, either using cars, garbage dumpsters, or some other form of barricade to prevent rioters from entering, or at least making it harder for them to enter. Rioters will look for easier points of entry, and any obstacle or barrier you can add
will make them look elsewhere. Like with home intruders, most look for the easy opportunities and typically want to avoid resistance, conflict, and prey on easy targets. Map out the different entry points into your neighborhood and have a plan to spring into action if a potential riot is forming in your area. Most people react to situations, but having a plan in place allows you to be proactive and get ahead of the problem before it's too late. Don't allow your neighborhood to be an easy target. Prepare the grounds. You'll need to prepare your home for the possibility of rioters and looters moving through your streets. Cars should be parked in garages or parked somewhere safer. Flower pots, rocks, or anything else that can be easily picked up and thrown should be brought in or moved inside fenced locations. Trash cans should not be left on the curb, because starting fires in trash cans and moving them against or inside buildings is a common action for rioters. Window shades, curtains, or blinds should be drawn and closed to keep concealed any valuables you may have inside. To really stay ahead of the possibility of rioters, consider applying a clear security film to windows. This affordable option will keep your windows from shattering when people hit it with a projectile or blunt force object. Even without rioters ever appearing in your neighborhood, window security films are great to add a barrier between you and any would-be intruder. As a deterrent, they will slow down intruders and they will place one more hurdle they will have to work against to gain access to your home over any other home. If you're a shop or business owner in an area that may see violence, I cannot recommend clear security films enough to you. It will make looting your shop far less desirable. If you have it prepared in advance, making X patterns on your windows with duct tape will keep them from shattering completely and can be used as a quick last resort. Finally, you may consider having sheets of plywood that can quickly be mounted just as you would to protect your home against a hurricane. The downside of this is the space they require to store and the fact that they limit your ability to see and respond to an exterior threat. An open and shattered window in a riot situation should be considered the same as an open door. To completely prepare your grounds, and just as a general security measure I recommend in many of my videos, reinforce your doors. Both the strike plate and the frame can affordably be reinforced to require thousands more pounds of pressure than a karate kick or shoulder can produce. Prepare for fire. The rioter has two main destructive tools at their disposal, rocks and fire. Unfortunately, you can't go throughout your neighborhood removing all the fist-sized landscaping rocks, and that is another reason to consider security films for your windows. More destructive than rocks, though, is the threat of fire. Again, bring in any trash cans or remove any clear ignition sources around your property. Dead brushes you haven't gotten to clearing out should be immediately cleared. Bring in any propane tanks from exterior grills, heating units, or fire pits. Apply the same 30-foot rule applied to homeowners under threat of wildfires. Look at your perimeter for 30 feet and look for anything combustible, from lawn flags to dry trees to piles of fall leaves and old tires. If you know rioters and looters are in your neighborhood or near your neighborhood, make sure you hose down any wooden shingles on your roof, wooden fences, and turn your sprinklers on and let them run. Even a wet and slippery lawn is a form of deterrence. The wetter, the better. Even lightly spraying off your exterior walls can be enough to keep any incendiary device from spreading further. Have a fire extinguisher on hand, as you should for standard home safety. Remove the tool of fire from rioters and looters and keep your property safe. Lights, camera, action. The best deterrent of unwanted invaders are lights, cameras, and the possibility of action on your part. First, lights. Obviously, lights are only an effective deterrent from dusk to dawn, but this is a critical time when you and your property are somewhat vulnerable. A well-lit perimeter is not as inviting to a rioter or a burglar as a dark or heavily shadowed property. If you live in a suburban tract, lights also help your neighbors and community respond when you cannot. Solar motion lights have gone up in lumens and down in price and energy consumption. Because they are self-contained, they continue functioning when the power goes out, and they can be installed and made operational with very little effort and no need to hardwire into your electrical system. Assess the perimeter of your home and make sure exterior walls, windows, and gates are well lit. Motion cameras, doorbell cameras, CCTV, security mirrors, even fake round plastic domes are another form of deterrent. When someone knows they are doing wrong, it is inherent in their thinking to avoid being caught on video or seen. Nobody trying to break into a house, light a fire, even throw a rock really wants that video admitted as evidence later on in their court case. They don't want the police using a screen capture to identify them later. There are several low-cost motion-activated cameras available from multiple providers that can allow you to monitor several streams around your whole house, post captured videos to network neighborhood groups, or even have your videos monitored by a 24-hour service. I have to stress here that lights and cameras are not going to stop all rioters emboldened by the opportunity to be lawless. They're not a guarantee. What they are is nothing more than a deterrent. A well-illuminated and monitored home, or one that appears so, gives the impression that there is a vigilant homeowner inside that is ready to defend his property and life if need be. Rioters are likely to move to softer targets. If the majority of your community is well-lit and it appears to be visually monitored, rioters are likely to favor softer targets or retail versus residential areas where they will be able to loot to a greater degree. Know your neighborhood and neighbors. While the first part of this video addresses the specific measures you can take around your suburban or urban home, the second part of this video focuses on leveraging your neighborhood resources. First, know your neighborhood. So many people in tract housing developments open their garage, leave for work the same way out of their neighborhood, and return the same way and close the garage door behind them. The hotter the climate, the more likely this is to be the norm. But you really have to know your neighborhood. Even your apartment building or a condominium at a boots on the ground level. What are the means of entry and egress from your neighborhood? Are there any specific roads, community parks, or sidewalks that lead into your neighborhood from business areas or areas of larger populace? Do you know the neighbors who are at these key points of entry and exit? Second, know your neighbors. Who in your neighborhood is a first responder, health professional, police officer, military, veteran, private security? Can you form a patrolling group or a watch and monitoring schedule to make sure you have eyes on your neighborhood throughout the night? Can you post people at apartment door entrances or at entry points from your neighborhood? Armed guards at entry points in the neighborhoods or apartment buildings can deter even the boldest of criminals. In addition to forming networks with these people who can help in an emergency, remember that you are part of a whole neighborhood. Know the vulnerable people in your neighborhood as well. Are there elderly people in your neighborhood who may need assistance? Have an escape plan and bag. Your neighborhood and your home is obviously your last and final stand. Between your own efforts and your neighborhood's efforts, it should be enough. There's always a possibility, however, as we have seen in instances of fire, where you absolutely have to flee your home or apartment for safer locations. Making a final stand in a building burning around you is not going to be successful. To ensure your safety, always have an escape plan and a bug-out bag. Make sure your bag has any necessary medicines as well. If you live in an urban or suburban environment, the likelihood you may have to leave your premises is higher. Know your escape routes. Favor escape routes that move away from populous areas, avoid crowds, and circumvent conflict zones. Leaving the safety of your home is always the final and last resort, and should only be done when all possibilities of staying have been eliminated. You may be able to fall back on other neighbors. Leverage technology. Leverage technology to maintain security and awareness. Using apps like Twitter, Facebook, Neighborhoodland, Nextdoor, Life360, Ring, or WhatsApp can help you network your neighborhood and allows people to report problems, threats, or suspicious activities easily. Sometimes public and HOA locations have webcams that you can monitor to track movements of people in your community who shouldn't be there. Even forming a community text string or applications like Slack can provide you a network group of active eyes and could provide instant message alerts to activities in your area. Do you have a drone? Why not deploy it for surveillance in your neighborhood? You can track movements and alert others in your community while also creating a video record with even a low-end drone. You can use a bird's eye satellite view in Google Maps to make neighborhood watch patrol assignment maps or assess possible weak points of entry points into your neighborhood. Armed with this information, you can determine which areas of your neighborhood might need more protection or surveillance. If you are preparing well in advance, you can lobby your homeowners association or neighborhood watch group for the installation of open IP cameras in high traffic and public areas. This will allow anyone with the right access and passwords to log in and observe points throughout the neighborhood. Outdoor weatherproof cameras have become very affordable in recent years. These cameras can be easily installed outside public areas or willing neighborhood houses and aimed at neighborhood entrances and exits. Access to the cameras can be restricted to just people within your neighborhood to prevent unauthorized viewing. The streams can be viewed throughout most web browsers without the need for any specialized software. Walkie-talkies or CBs shared with key neighbors can keep you in communication with one another even if cell service goes out. In short, leverage technology to integrate networks of eyes and ears on your community. Use technology to help you create 24/7 security. The more in advance you prepare, the better your preparations can be. Perhaps your neighborhood will never be infiltrated by mobs seeking to cause destruction and rob you, but measures you take now to protect yourself against a possibility will also have the added benefit of protecting you from everyday crime, even some natural disasters. Observing the 30-foot perimeter for fires, for example, protects you better from wildfires. Strengthening your doors and reviewing your lighting helps to protect you from other crimes. Networking your neighborhood groups in person and electronically makes your neighborhood less attractive for bad guys and gives you early notifications about bad situations brewing in your community. They allow for many eyes and ears on your neighborhood and allow you to outnumber the mob that may be in your neighborhood. Rocks, fires, numbers, and anonymity are the weapons of the rioter. When you reduce the threats of rocks and fire, when you surveil and watch them to remove their anonymity, and when you display unified neighborhood vigilance, you make your neighborhood and your home less attractive to looters. They will opt for less vigilant, less protected neighborhoods, even if the looting score is less. Always take the time during the first few hours after video is released to read and respond to comments. If you have any thoughts or feedback, please post those in the comments section, and I usually try to respond within the first couple of hours. Subscribe to this channel or my newsletter for member-specific content, and as always, stay safe out there.
One of the most common questions that comes up after I reference precious metals in a video is, what value do precious metals even have after SHTF? Now, before you run to the comments section and say it has no value, just bear with me and listen to the entirety of this video. I purposely have kept this video relatively short, and I ask that you stick with me until the end as I wrap up the question with an answer that once you listen to the entirety of the video, you'll understand the value of precious metals. Now, if any time you're interested in picking up any of the precious metals for your prepper inventory that we're going to be talking about, I'll put a link in the description section below where I personally buy them. So track with me here for a moment. Any true prolonged SHTF situation has four distinct phases: the early warnings, the collapse, endurance, and recovery phases. Now, fortunately, history in hindsight has taught us a good deal about what these phases will look like. The most valuable things to you in all four phases, obviously, are the three Bs that preppers always love to talk about: bullets, beans, and band-aids. Now, obviously, when the grid goes down, food will be the most valuable commodity. I won't argue with that. But beyond these three Bs, what is the role of precious metals? I'd like to walk with you through these four phases, and I'll explain the role of precious metals throughout each phase. Okay, so in this video, we're going to look at a scenario where SHTF has happened. Now, SHTF stands for shit hits a fan. Now, this is a scenario where things have fallen apart entirely, and it's up to each person to handle their own survival for either a short or a long period of time. What I'll do in this video is I'll walk you through the four phases, and at the end, we'll tie this all together in a way that will make sense to you. So let's jump in. Stage number one, the early warnings phase. I personally think there's more than enough warning signs that things are about to shake out in the world over the next decade and the next few years for that matter. And those that are prepared will do better than those that are not prepared. We are living in a moment in history where people realize they need to get ready. It's something you can sense right now. The early phase is the preparation phase for you. It is where you should be making sure you have an adequate supply of your essentials. Those items lumped into, again, the three Bs: beans, bullets, and band-aids. But do precious metals hold any value in this phase? The answer is yes. Following any disaster, man-made or natural, economies do suffer. They often dip with people's perceptions of how bad and how long it will last. When the markets suffer, or the dollar declines in value, or both, precious metals typically rise in value. Now, I'm not a financial advisor, and I'm not trying to give you financial advice. But if you're observing what is happening right now with the Fed printing money and driving up the national debt, you can observe the spike in demand for precious metals as investors are looking to move their fiat currency to a safe haven, with precious metals being just one of the many assets that they're currently pursuing. If your currency collapses, the universal currency of precious metals will allow you to still make transactions, but again, not in the immediate phase after a collapse, which we'll talk about next. Stage two, the collapse phase. Now, this is the phase that most preppers focus on when they send me emails or a comment on my videos when I talk about precious metals. I often hear the comments of, you can't eat gold or food will be more valuable. And guess what? You're right. In the collapse phase, precious metals have the least amount of value to you, though they may increase in value against the currency. A look at the post-World War I Weimar Republic is a great example of this. In January 1919, an ounce of gold cost more than 170 German marks.
Now, 4 years and 10 months later, in November of 1923, 1 ounce of gold cost 87 trillion German marks. In US dollars, though, an ounce of gold was around $21. The German mark was useless. A wheelbarrow full of it wouldn't even have bought you a loaf of bread. During this collapse phase, precious metals may hold some trade value for you with people who either deny the collapse is happening or who believe in a quick recovery phase. This is the last phase I would actually try to use them to negotiate or buy with someone in the same economy, as you'll get the least return for them. You can't haul large amounts of them if you're forced to bug out. And if they are being held electronically for you, you may not be able to have access to the systems needed to obtain value from them, which is why I always recommend people actually receive them and hold them in a safe location. Now, stage three is called the endurance phase. The endurance phase in prepping is really what you should be prepping for. Here is where you're gonna need the three B's again, which we've talked about. This is where they come into play. Here too is where any durable goods, shelter and water and anything that will sustain you will become critical. You have to endure the tragedy. You have to survive until you can make it to the recovery phase. Okay, so now we're at stage four, which is the recovery phase. Having run through the first three phases, this is where precious metals really shine, no pun intended. The recovery phase is where precious metals truly have value for you. So much of prepping attention is focused on the collapse and the endurance phases of a disaster. Many preppers act as if the end result of every instance will be some Mad Max post-apocalyptic landscape. While that is always one possible outcome and can serve as a motivator and guide for your preparations, history has shown us that a recovery phase follows in every instance. We're here today, obviously. It is during this last phase, the recovery phase, where precious metals will be exchangeable for land, currency, or whatever else you need. While replacement currencies may come into play, gold, silver, and copper, they'll allow you to acquire new currency. This is the sell phase of your precious metals. Okay, so you've gotten this far. Now what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna take all this information and I'm gonna, you know, use some fiat currency, and we're gonna look at precious metals, and I'm gonna try to wrap this up in a way that will hopefully make sense. Think about it this way. If a SHTF situation truly occurs and the grid is down for a very long time and we come into a truly catastrophic event which leaves everyone fending for their own, fiat currency like the dollar will be worthless. It's just paper and it will have no value. Cash is not an asset in and of itself. It's merely an agreement between two parties in which we assign value to this item because it's backed by a government. Now, when things eventually come back to normal, if you're holding a lot of paper money, it will be worthless during a rebuild. But if you hold an asset like precious metals, you now have something that will be recognized as value, and it will allow you to move forward with something of high value. You can think of the example we gave earlier of the collapse of the Weimar Republic. Fiat paper currency became worthless. People without assets had to start from scratch. But if you have a tangible asset that has value, you can now move back into the markets with something of value. It's essentially transferring value from fiat to precious metals, and when things restore, you can move the value out of this asset back into a fiat market, whatever that's going to look like, to begin buying things you need. But fiat currency can't do that. If everything truly collapses, fiat currency becomes worthless and may not come back to the value once things restore. The currency the new government sets up will be completely different, and this will be nothing but paper. They may not even recognize this anymore. But precious metals, on the other hand, they hold value. While during the first few phases, it may have little value, at the end, during a recovery, it has been holding that value all along. So in other words, this is something that just holds value. It's just a transfer system out of this into this, and then you can eventually move back into whatever the currency is going to look like when things are restored. So to answer the question, should precious metals be a part of your prepping inventory? Quite simply, yes. Not in the immediate aftermath, but if you're looking at the long game, hopefully you'll see the value. After your three B's are secure, you should consider adding precious metals to your inventory. Now, you can't eat or drink precious metals, but along the way, they can help you secure both food and water. Having precious metals in your inventory, it's a strategy based on insulating yourself from the economic impact of any disaster.
throughout each of the four phases, warning, collapse, endurance, and recovery, precious metals will retain some value, even if that value fluctuates based upon circumstances. It is really the recovery phase of any calamity where they will have their greatest value. They can help you emerge from the darkness of a tragic situation faster and stronger. Even though the new world that emerges may look completely different from the pre-disaster world you came from. Hopefully this video gave you enough information to determine whether precious metals is a right fit for your prepper inventory. If you enjoyed it, please click on the like button, share on social media, and provide any thoughts or feedback in the comments section below. As always, learn so much from the community. As always, stay safe out there.
We have never had a more contentious election. We have rarely seen such deep-rooted animosities and hostilities in America. Our nation is divided by ideology and perspective so greatly that it almost seems to be living in two separate realities. These realities are built upon by an incessant stream of video, news, commentary, and sometimes false information, which bolster the polar opposite realities and further stoke the fires of division and hate. Will this raging fire of division tear the country apart? That remains to be seen. What we do know is that at some point after Election Day, whether the people, the Electoral College, the House of Representatives, or the Supreme Court decides it, Trump or Biden will be our president. In this video, we will examine what may happen when Trump is our president for a second term. What would the populist reaction, the political moves, and what can we do to stay safe? Please consider subscribing to our newsletter to give you updates and member-specific content. Visit www.cityprepping.com/newsletter or click on the link in the description and comment section below to subscribe today. Enjoy the video. The populist reaction. You probably clicked on this video because you strongly agreed or strongly disagreed with the title. Assuming you consider yourself a relatively calm and level-headed person, take that deep-rooted feeling in you, multiply it by 100 or more, and spread it out over the entire United States. And that's the reaction you will get from the populace after this election concludes. Look at how contentious and vitriolic the comments section is probably right now. You will find someone in there that would label you as crazy, regardless of which candidate wins the election. To say there is an abundance of energy about this election outcome would be an understatement. So how will the populace react to Trump winning a second term? After the 2016 election, millions of voters took to the streets to express their frustrations over a popular vote that went one way, and an electoral vote that went another way. While that scenario wasn't new to the political landscape, America saw a larger outcropping of people in the streets than they had ever seen before. Still, by today's new standards, that crowd, even as large as it was pretty tame, calm, and peaceful. Will conflict spread onto the streets and cities near you? I can't say that with certainty, but the American population seems to think so. Sales and online purchases of tactical apparel have experienced a 20-fold increase in sales this year. According to the founder of Mirror Safety, it doesn't always matter who gets elected. They, his customers, think that no matter who wins, Biden or Trump, there are going to be a lot of people who are upset with the result. A shift became apparent with this spring's Black Lives Matter protests and bitterly resented pandemic lockdowns. Now the gear is everywhere, from camouflage-clad Antifa supporters to right-wing extremists who appeared at Michigan's Capitol even after men were arrested in a plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And Americans of both sides of the political spectrum are heavily armed. Guns and ammo sales across the country have also surged. The U.S. population accounts for 46% of the global total of all small firearms. This amounts to 120 firearms for every 100 residents. So what happens when an angry and heavily armed mob of people take to the streets and are met with an equally and or more heavily armed opposition? Trump, who has established his reputation as the law and order president and has shown himself to be with his use of federal forces to suppress insurrection, will not tolerate American streets turned into war zones. Likewise, an army of Trump will undoubtedly take to the streets to defend America. Whatever comes of this scenario, it isn't good for the population as a whole or for the country. Dissent, when Trump wins re-election, might not rise to the point of armed events, but it could take other forms that could impact your life nonetheless. Liberal-leaning unions may encourage their employees to have a sick out or an organized period of unwarranted sick leave taken as a form of group protest. What happens to an economy struggling to regain its posture from the effects of the lockdown? sufferers further from the economic effects of a walkout or strike from a union or labor organization currently endorsing Biden, like the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, the Service Employees International Union, or the United Food and Commercial Workers. Combined, these organizations have nearly 10 million members. Not only would the economy as a whole suffer, but disruptions of food and fuel services, emergency and police services, and normal day-to-day operations would be highly likely. And this underscores the need to prepare, even with a clear Trump victory. The world's reaction. How will the world react to Trump's win? His hard stance on NATO paying their fair share of their own defenses, which they are now doing, his ongoing trade war with China, his further closing of borders and tightening of citizenship and immigration policies will undoubtedly further frustrate other countries. Add to this that America's adversaries aren't suddenly going to stop their planned and real physical and virtual attacks on us. Though we have enemies growing from within, our enemies who are foreign adversaries continue to threaten our American way of life. Will Israel, a country that has somewhat aligned itself with this administration, be emboldened enough to take on the nuclear threat that is Iran? Could that draw us into yet another conflict in the Middle East? Will China, frustrated by the continued trade war and retaliation for a cultural loss of face for allowing the COVID-19 virus to escape their borders, launch a cryptocurrency pegged to the yuan to destabilize the US dollar, seize more land and airspace in the South China Sea, tear up trade agreements or forge new ones to the exclusion of the United States? There are countless more scenarios with many other countries that could threaten our economic stability, draw America into a foreign conflict. Even if the whole nation doesn't react in any significant way, we have had to remain vigilant to the fact that terrorist groups and clandestine operations by foreign governments remain a threat to our security. Either could seek to amplify our divisiveness and further our divide by bringing down infrastructure systems or creating violent conflicts and receding in the shadows while the finger pointing continues. The effects of just one explosion by an unknown adversary on election day could put the entire election in question. That chaos may not be a result of any American citizen's action, but the reaction could further our divide. In short, our enemies aren't cowering in fear right now. They're emboldened and encouraged by our division because of the opportunities it creates to destroy our way of life. When Trump, who globally seems to be considered an underdog in this election, wins, the global perception of America may change. Could other countries seek to align themselves without the United States and even push for fiat currency to compete against the US dollar? Only history will tell. As one writer put it, looking back on US diplomatic history, one of the great counterfactuals is what would have happened if Franklin D. Roosevelt had not replaced his vice president, Henry Wallace, with Harry Truman in 1944. Wallace was sympathetic to the Soviet Union and became an ardent opponent to the Cold War. If he had been president when FDR died in April of 1945, the next half century would have been completely different. Likely no NATO, no Marshall Plan, no alliance with Japan, no overseas troop presence, and no European Union. Undeniably, the global view of America might change significantly when Trump wins. Trump's tough foreign policies and refusal to allow America to be a part of agreements he doesn't feel are in America's best interests have ruffled a few feathers and antagonized a few allies who are currently adopting a wait-and-see attitude to see if Trump's first term was an American blip or a signal of a new American way of thinking and acting on a world stage. We could become globally more unified or more divided with our policies. We could be perceived as stronger or weaker. Much will be determined by Trump's second term political moves. Presidents and their policies determine and guide global perceptions. The political moves. Politically, when Trump wins his second term, he will be emboldened by the endorsement of the American people, further secure his loyalists around him, and double down on his policy issues established in the first 4 years. His policies of the anti-establishment government will have more strength and more teeth. The traditional government structures will be changed. Likely, we could see someone like Jared Kushner as the National Security Advisor. We would see more executive actions. We would see more court cases decided in favor of the administration by a conservative Supreme Court. Very likely, those who enter the country illegally or were born here from parents who enter the country illegally will be denied government social services and in some cases deported. That wall that has been talked about will probably be built. The Affordable Care Act will undoubtedly be overturned because of the unconstitutionality of the individual mandate invalidating it. And before the plan Trump plans on implementing is put into place, many will not have health care. School choice will become the norm, and a host of other policy issues will be decided and implemented. traditional and long-standing laws that favored the establishment government will be challenged and decided. Investigations launched by Democrats will be stopped, and Democrats will be investigated for their alleged crimes. The political moves of President Trump in his second term will significantly change the American landscape, but they will also be perceived as too drastic and jarring by large swaths of the country. Whole states may resist federally mandated changes. Populous areas of the country with liberal leadership may dissent in large numbers and may be met with equal or greater forces, federal and civilian, defending Trump. What you need to prepare for. So what can you do now? What should you do? What should you prepare for? First, you need to adopt a calm and rational observation stance of what is going on around you. Realize that any conflict may actually have been started by a foreign adversary. Don't rush to blame until you clearly see all the facts. Second, prepare for the need to lock down during any periods of heightened civil unrest. Prepare yourself by watching some of the other informative videos on this channel or visiting cityprepping.com. I've recently done videos on protecting your neighborhood from rioters, protecting your home from intruders, and even items to grab at Walmart right now before it's too late. If any pockets of chaos do spring up, it may take a long period of time before the government can reestablish control. Attacks on our power grid and other critical infrastructures cannot be entirely ruled out, as our nation's enemies will seek to amplify divisions in our country. Your preparations for successfully living off-grid for a period of time will be of great benefit to you. Make any remaining purchases of items you need to complete your inventory and supplies prior to Election Day. Here I'm not suggesting you mortgage the farm or run up your credit cards. Just bolster your supplies and durable goods as much as you can, within reason, and keep a keen focus on the essentials of food, water, durable goods, and personal protection. Prepare now. What we do know is that at some point after Election Day, whether the people, the Electoral College, the House of Representatives, or the Supreme Court decides it, Trump or Biden will be our president. Given this nation's deepening divisions in ideological perspectives and polar opposition to each other, we have to rationally accept the possibility that any presidential win will not be met with widespread acceptance and good-heartedness. It is a resulting conflict that can arise from within or from other adversaries who would seek to do us harm that we should prepare for. With this event, this election, prepare like you know the natural disaster is coming, like you can see it approaching on the Doppler radar. If nothing at all happens and everything remains calm everywhere, you will be prepared for other disasters that may come in the future. So preparation now will still benefit you later. I'd love to hear your post-election predictions. I know most of us hope we will see nothing out of the unusual, but I would love to hear your comments below. To see what will happen when Biden wins the election, click on that link in the video. I'll post a link in the cards above, as I've created a separate video to give this possibility equal time. Always take the time during the first few hours after a video is released to read and respond to comments. Subscribe to this channel or my newsletter for member-specific content. And as always, stay safe out there.